Statistication. The title of this book and some of the things in it might seem to imply that all such operations are the product of intent to deceive. The president of a chapter of the American Statistical Association once called me down for that. "Not chicanery much of the time," said he, "but incompetence." There may be something in what he says, but I'm not certain that one assumption will be less offensive to statisticians than the other. Possibly more important to keep in mind is that the distortion of statistical data and its manipulation to an end are not always the work of professional statisticians. What comes full of virtue from the statistician's desk may find itself twisted, exaggerated, oversimplified, and distorted through selection by salesman, public relations expert, journalist, or advertising copywriter. But whoever the guilty party may be in any instance, it's hard to grant him the status of blundering innocent. False charts in magazines and newspapers, frequently sensationalized by exaggeration, rarely minimize anything. Those who present statistical arguments on behalf of industry are seldom found, in my experience, giving labor or the customer a better break than the facts call for. And often they give him a worse one. When has a union employed a statistical worker so incompetent that he made labor's case out weaker than it was? As long as the errors remain one-sided, it's not easy to attribute them to bungling or accident. One of the trickiest ways to misrepresent statistical data is by means of a map. A map introduces a fine bag of variables in which facts can be concealed and relationships distorted. My favorite trophy in this field is the Darkening Shadow. It was distributed not long ago by the First National Bank of Boston and reproduced very widely by so-called taxpayers groups, newspapers, and Newsweek magazine. The map shows what portion of our national income is now being taken and spent by the federal government. It does this by shading the areas of the states west of the Mississippi, excepting only Louisiana, Arkansas, and part of Missouri, to indicate that federal spending has now become equal to the total incomes of the people in those states. The deception lies in choosing states having large areas, but because of sparse population, relatively small incomes. With equal honesty and equal dishonesty, the mapmaker might have started shading in New York or New England and come out with a vastly smaller and less impressive shadow. Using the same data, he would have produced quite a different impression in the mind of anyone who looked at his map. No one would have bothered to distribute that one, though. At least, I don't know of any powerful group that is interested in making public spending appear to be smaller than it is. If the objective of the mapmaker had been simply to convey information, he could have done so quite easily. He could have chosen a group of in-between states whose total area bears the same relation to the area of the country that their total income does to the national income. The thing that makes this map a particularly flagrant effort to misguide is that it's not a new trick of propaganda. It is something of a classic or chestnut. The same bank long ago published versions of this map to show federal expenditures in 1929 and 1937, and these shortly cropped up in a standard book, Graphic Presentation by Willard Cope Brinton, as horrible examples. "This method," quote, "distorts the facts," said Brinton plainly. But the First National goes right on drawing its maps, and Newsweek and other people who should know better, and possibly do, go right on reproducing them with neither warning nor apology. What is the average income of American families? As we noted earlier, for 1949, the Bureau of the Census says that the income of the average family was $3,100. But if you read a newspaper story on philanthropic giving handed out by the Russell Sage Foundation, you learned that for the same year, it was a notable $5,004. Possibly you were pleased to learn that folks were doing so well. But you may also have been struck by how poorly that figure squared with your own observations. Possibly you know the wrong kind of people. Now, how in the world can Russell Sage and the Bureau of the Census be so far apart? The Bureau is talking in medians, as of course it should be. But even if the Sage people are using a mean, the difference should not be quite this great. The Russell Sage Foundation, it turns out, discovered this remarkable prosperity by producing what can only be described as a phony family. Their method, they explained, when asked for an explanation, was to divide the total personal income of the American people by 149 million to get an average of $1,251 for each person, which, they added, becomes $5,004 in a family of four. This odd piece of statistical manipulation exaggerates in two ways. It uses the kind of average called a mean instead of the smaller and more informative median, something we worked over in an earlier chapter. And then it goes on to assume that the income of a family is in direct proportion to its size. Now, I have four children, and I wish things were disposed in that way, but they aren't. Families of four are by no means commonly twice as wealthy as families of two. In fairness to the Russell Sage statisticians, who may be presumed innocent of desire to deceive, it should be said that they were primarily interested in making a picture of giving rather than of getting. The funny figure for family incomes was just a byproduct. But it spread its deception no less effectively for that, and it remains a prime example of why little faith can be placed in an unqualified statement of average. For a spurious air of precision that will lend all kinds of weight to the most disreputable statistic, consider the decimal. Ask 100 citizens how many hours they slept last night. Come out with a total of, say, 783.1. Any such data are far from precise to begin with. Most people will miss their guess by 15 minutes or more, and there is no assurance that the errors will balance out. We all know someone who will recall 5 sleepless minutes as half a night of tossing insomnia. But go ahead, do your arithmetic, and announce that people sleep an average of 7.831 hours a night. You will sound as if you knew precisely what you were talking about. If you had been so foolish as to declare that people sleep 7.8 or almost 8 hours a night, there would have been nothing striking about it. It would have sounded like what it was, a poor approximation and no more instructive than almost anybody's guess. Karl Marx was not above achieving a spurious air of precision in the same fashion. In figuring the rate of surplus value in a mill, he began with a splendid collection of assumptions, guesses, and round numbers. Quote, "We assume the waste to be 6%. The raw material costs, in round numbers, 342 pounds. The 10,000 spindles cost, we will assume, 1 pound per spindle. The wear and tear we put at 10%. The rent of the building we suppose to be 300 pounds. He says, "The above data, which may be relied upon, were given me by a Manchester spinner. From these approximations, Marx calculates that, quote, the rate of surplus value is therefore 80 over 52, or 153 11/13%. For a 10-hour day, this gives him necessary labor at 3 31/33 hours, and surplus labor at 6 2/33 hours. There's a nice feeling of exactness to all that 2/33 of an hour, but it's all bluff. Percentages offer a fertile field for confusion, and like the ever-impressive decimal, they can lend an aura of precision to the inexact. The United States Department of Labor's Monthly Labor Review once stated that of the offers of part-time household employment with provisions for carfare in Washington, D.C. during a specified month, 4.9%, were at $18 a week. This percentage, it turned out, was based on precisely two cases, there having been only 41 offers altogether. Any percentage figure based on a small number of cases is likely to be misleading. It is more informative to give the figure itself. And when the percentage is carried out to decimal places, you begin to run the scale from the silly to the fraudulent. Buy your Christmas presents now and save 100%, advises an advertisement. This sounds like an offer worthy of old Santa himself. But it turns out to be merely a confusion of base. The reduction is only 50%. The saving is 100% of the reduced or new price, it's true, but that isn't what the offer says. Likewise, when the president of a flower growers association said, in a newspaper interview, that flowers are 100% cheaper than 4 months ago, he didn't mean that florists were now giving them away. But that's what he said. In her History of the Standard Oil Company, Ida M. Tarbell went even further. She said that, quote, price cutting in the Southwest ranged from 14 to 220%. That would call for seller paying buyer a considerable sum to haul the oily stuff away. The Columbus Dispatch declared that a manufactured product was selling at a profit of 3,800%, basing this on a cost of $1.75 and a selling price of $40. In calculating percentage of profits, you have a choice of methods, and you are obligated to indicate which one you're using. If figured on cost, this one comes to a profit of 2,185%. On selling price, 95.6%. The Dispatch apparently used a method of its own, and as so often seems to happen, got an exaggerated figure to report. Even the New York Times lost the battle of the shifting base in publishing an Associated Press story from Indianapolis. The Depression took a stiff wallop on the chin here today. Plumbers, plasterers, carpenters, painters, and others affiliated with the Indianapolis Building Trades Union were given a 5% increase in wages. That gave back to the men one-fourth of the 20% cut they took last winter. Sounds reasonable on the face of it, but the decrease has been figured on one base, the pay the men were getting in the first place, while the increase uses a smaller base, the pay level after the cut. You can check on this bit of statistical misfiguring by supposing, for simplicity, that the original wage was $1 an hour. Cut 20%. It is down to 80 cents. A 5% increase on that is 4 cents, which is not one-fourth but one-fifth of the cut. Like so many presumably honest mistakes, this one somehow managed to come out an exaggeration, which made a better story. All this illustrates why, to offset a pay cut of 50%, you must get a raise of 100%. It was the Times also that once reported that, for a fiscal year, airmail lost through fire was 4,863 pounds, or a percentage of but 0.00063. The story said that planes had carried 7,715,741 pounds of mail during the year. An insurance company basing its rates in that way could get into a pack of trouble. Figure the loss, and you'll find that it came to 0.063%, or 100 times as great as the newspaper had it. It is the illusion of the shifting base that accounts for the trickiness of adding discounts. When a hardware jobber offers 50% and 20% off list, he doesn't mean a 70% discount. The cut is 60%. Since the 20% is figured on the smaller base left after taking off 50%. A good deal of bumbling and chicanery have come from adding together things that don't add up, but merely seem to. Children for generations have been using a form of this device to prove that they don't go to school. You probably recall it. Starting with 365 days to the year, you can subtract 122 for the one-third of the time you spend in bed and another 45 for the 3 hours a day used in eating. From the remaining 198, take away 90 for summer vacation and 21 for Christmas and Easter vacations. The days that remain are not even enough to provide for Saturdays and Sundays. Too ancient and obvious a trick to use in serious business, you might say. But the United Automobile Workers insist in their monthly magazine, Ammunition, that it is still being used against them. The wide blue yonder lie also turns up during every strike. Every time there is a strike, the Chamber of Commerce advertises that the strike is costing so many millions of dollars a day. They get the figure by adding up all the cars that would have been made if the strikers had worked full time. They add in losses to suppliers in the same way. Everything possible is added in, including streetcar fares and the loss to merchants in sales. The similar and equally odd notion that percentages can be added together as freely as apples has been used against authors. See how convincing this one, from the New York Times Book Review, sounds. The gap between advancing book prices and authors' earnings, it appears, is due to substantially higher production and materials costs. Item. Plant and manufacturing expenses alone have risen as much as 10 to 12% over the last decade. Materials are up 6 to 9%. Selling and advertising expenses have climbed upwards of 10%. Combined boosts add up to a minimum of 33% for one company and to nearly 40% for some of the smaller houses. Actually, if each item making up the cost of publishing this book has risen around 10%, the total cost must have climbed by about that proportion also. The logic that permits adding those percentage rises together could lead to all sorts of flights of fancy. Buy 20 things today and find that each has gone up 5% over the last year. That adds up to 100%, and the cost of living has doubled. Nonsense. It's all a little like the tale of the roadside merchant who was asked to explain how he could sell rabbit sandwiches so cheap. "Well," he said, "I have to put in some horse meat, too, but I mix them 50-50. One horse, one rabbit." A union publication used a cartoon to object to another variety of unwarranted adding up. It showed the boss adding one regular hour at $1.50 to one overtime hour at $2.25 to one double-time hour at $3 for an average hourly wage of $2.25. It would be hard to find an instance of an average with less meaning. Another fertile field for being fooled lies in the confusion between percentage and percentage points. If your profits should climb from 3% on investment 1 year to 6% the next, you can make it sound quite modest by calling it a rise of 3 percentage points. With equal validity, you can describe it as a 100% increase. For loose handling of this confusing pair, watch particularly the public opinion pollers. Percentiles are deceptive too. When you are told how Johnny stands compared to his classmates in algebra or some aptitude, the figure may be a percentile. It means his rank in each 100 students. In a class of 300, for instance, the top three will be at the 99 percentile, the next three at the 98, and so on. The odd thing about percentiles is that a student with a 99 percentile rating is probably quite a bit superior to one standing at 90, while those at the 40 and 60 percentiles may be of almost equal achievement. This comes from the habit that so many characteristics have of clustering about their own average, forming the normal bell curve we mentioned in an early chapter. Occasionally, a battle of the statisticians develops, and even the most unsophisticated observer cannot fail to smell a rat. Honest men get a break when statisticulators fall out. The Steel Industry Board has pointed out some of the monkey business in which both steel companies and unions have indulged. To show how good business had been in 1948, as evidence that the companies could well afford a raise. The union compared that year's productivity with that of 1939, a year of especially low volume. The companies, not to be outdone in the deception derby, insisted on making their comparisons on a basis of money received by the employees rather than average hourly earnings. The point to this was that so many workers had been on part-time in the earlier year that their incomes were bound to have grown, even if wage rates had not risen at all. Time magazine, notable for the consistent excellence of its graphics, published a chart that is an amusing example of how statistics can pull out of the bag almost anything that may be wanted. Faced with a choice of methods, equally valid, one favoring the management viewpoint and the other favoring labor, Time simply used both. The chart was really two charts, one superimposed upon the other. They used the same data. One showed wages and profits in billions of dollars. It was evident that both were rising and by more or less the same amount, and that wages involved perhaps six times as many dollars as profits did. The great inflationary pressure, it appeared, came from wages. The other part of the dual chart expressed the changes as percentages of increase. The wage line was relatively flat. The profit line shot sharply upward. Profits, it might be inferred, were principally responsible for inflation. You could take your choice of conclusions. Or, perhaps better, you could easily see that neither element could properly be singled out as the guilty one. It is sometimes a substantial service simply to point out that a subject in controversy is not as open and shut as it has been made to seem. Index numbers are vital matters to millions of people now that wage rates are often tied to them. It is perhaps worth noting what can be done to make them dance to any man's music. To take the simplest possible example, let's say that milk cost 20 cents a quart last year and bread was a nickel a loaf. This year, milk is down to a dime and bread has gone up to a dime. Now, what would you like to prove? Cost of living up? Cost of living down? Or no change? Consider last year as the base period, making the prices of that time 100%. Since the price of milk has since dropped to half, 50%, and the price of bread has doubled, 200%, and the average of 50 and 200 is 125, prices have gone up 25%. Try it again, taking this year as base period. Milk used to cost 200% as much as it does now, and bread was selling for 50% as much. Average? 125%. Prices used to be 25% higher than they are now. To prove that the cost level hasn't changed at all, we simply switch to the geometric average and use either period as the base. This is a little different from the arithmetic average or mean that we have been using, but it is a perfectly legitimate kind of figure, and in some cases, the most useful and revealing. To get the geometric average of three numbers, you multiply them together and derive the cube root. For four items, the fourth root. For two, the square root. Like that. Take last year as the base and call its price level 100. Actually, you multiply the 100% for each item together and take the root, which is 100. For this year, milk being at 50% of last year and bread at 200%, multiply 50 by 200 to get 10,000. The square root, which is the geometric average, is 100. Prices have not gone up or down. The fact is that, despite its mathematical base, statistics is as much an art as it is a science. A great many manipulations and even distortions are possible within the bounds of propriety. Often the statistician must choose among methods, a subjective process, and find the one that he will use to represent the facts. In commercial practice, he is about as unlikely to select an unfavorable method as a copywriter is to call his sponsor's product flimsy and cheap, when he might as well say light and economical. Even the man in academic work may have a bias, possibly unconscious, to favor, a point to prove, an axe to grind. This suggests giving statistical material, the facts and figures in newspapers and books, magazines and advertising, a very sharp second look before accepting any of them. Sometimes a careful squint will sharpen the focus. But arbitrarily rejecting statistical methods makes no sense either. That is like refusing to read because writers sometimes use words to hide facts and relationships rather than to reveal them. After all, a political candidate in Florida not long ago made considerable capital by accusing his opponent of practicing celibacy. A New York exhibitor of the motion picture Quo Vadis used huge type to quote the New York Times as calling it historical pretentiousness. And the makers of Crazy Water Crystals, a proprietary medicine, have been advertising their product as providing quick, ephemeral relief. Chapter 10. How to Talk Back to a Statistic. So far, I have been addressing you rather as if you were a pirate, with a yen for instruction in the finer points of cutlass work. In this concluding chapter, I'll drop that literary device. I'll face up to the serious purpose that I like to think lurks just beneath the surface of this book. Explaining how to look a phony statistic in the eye and face it down. And, no less important, how to recognize sound and usable data in that wilderness of fraud to which the previous chapters have been largely devoted. Not all the statistical information that you may come upon can be tested with the sureness of a chemical analysis or of what goes on in an assayer's laboratory. But you can prod the stuff with five simple questions, and by finding the answers, avoid learning a remarkable lot that isn't so. Who says so? About the first thing to look for is bias. The laboratory with something to prove for the sake of a theory, a reputation, or a fee. The newspaper whose aim is a good story. Labor or management with a wage level at stake. Look for conscious bias. The method may be direct misstatement, or it may be ambiguous statement that serves as well and cannot be convicted. It may be selection of favorable data and suppression of unfavorable. Units of measurement may be shifted, as with the practice of using one year for one comparison and sliding over to a more favorable year for another. An improper measure may be used, a mean where a median would be more informative, perhaps all too informative, with the trickery covered by the unqualified word average. Look sharply for unconscious bias. It is often more dangerous. In the charts and predictions of many statisticians and economists in 1928, it operated to produce remarkable things. The cracks in the economic structure were joyously overlooked, and all sorts of evidence was adduced and statistically supported to show that we had no more than entered the stream of prosperity. It may take at least a second look to find out who says so. The who may be hidden by what Stephen Potter, the lifemanship man, would probably call the okay name. Anything smacking of the medical profession is an okay name. Scientific laboratories have okay names. So do colleges, especially universities, more especially ones eminent in technical work. The writer who proved a few chapters back that higher education jeopardizes a girl's chance to marry made good use of the okay name of Cornell. Please note that while the data came from Cornell, the conclusions were entirely the writer's own. But the okay name helps you carry away a misimpression of Cornell University says. When an okay name is cited, make sure that the authority stands behind the information, not merely somewhere alongside it. You may have read a proud announcement by the Chicago Journal of Commerce. That publication had made a survey. Of 169 corporations that replied to a poll on price gouging and hoarding, 2/3 declared that they were absorbing price increases produced by the Korean War. The survey shows, said the journal, look sharp whenever you meet those words, that corporations have done exactly the opposite of what the enemies of the American business system have charged. This is an obvious place to ask. Who says so? Since the Journal of Commerce might be regarded as an interested party. It is also a splendid place to ask our second test question. How does he know? It turns out that the journal had begun by sending its questionnaires to 1,200 large companies. Only 14% had replied. 86% had not cared to say anything in public on whether they were hoarding or price gouging. The journal had put a remarkably good face on things, but the fact remains that there was little to brag about. It came down to this. Of 1,200 companies polled, 9% said they hadn't raised prices, 5% said they had, and 86% wouldn't say. Those that had replied constituted a sample in which bias might be suspected. Watch out for evidence of a biased sample. One that has been selected improperly, or, as with this one, has selected itself. Ask the question we dealt with in an early chapter. Is the sample large enough to permit any reliable conclusion? Similarly, with a reported correlation, is it big enough to mean anything? Are there enough cases to add up to any significance? You cannot, as a casual reader, apply tests of significance or come to exact conclusions as to the adequacy of a sample. On a good many of the things you see reported, however, you will be able to tell at a glance, a good long glance perhaps, that there just weren't enough cases to convince any reasoning person of anything. What's missing? You won't always be told how many cases. The absence of such a figure, particularly when the source is an interested one, is enough to throw suspicion on the whole thing. Similarly, a correlation given without a measure of reliability, probable error, standard error, is not to be taken very seriously. Watch out for an average, variety unspecified, in any matter where mean and median might be expected to differ substantially. Many figures lose meaning because a comparison is missing. An article in Look magazine says, in connection with Down syndrome, that, quote, one study shows that in 2,800 cases, over half of the mothers were 35 or over. Getting any meaning from this depends upon your knowing something about the ages at which women in general produce babies. Few of us know things like that. Here's an extract from The New Yorker magazine's Letter from London of January 31st, 1953. The Ministry of Health's recently published figures showing that in the week of the Great Fog, the death rate for Greater London jumped by 2,800 were a shock to the public, which is used to regarding Britain's unpleasant climatic effects as nuisances rather than as killers. The extraordinary lethal properties of this winter's prize visitation. But how lethal was the visitation? Was it exceptional for the death rate to be that much higher than usual in a week? All such things do vary. And what about the ensuing weeks? Did the death rate drop below average, indicating that if the fog killed people, they were largely those who would have died shortly anyway? The figure sounds impressive, but the absence of other figures takes away most of its meaning. Sometimes it is percentages that are given and raw figures that are missing, and this can be deceptive too. Long ago, when Johns Hopkins University had just begun to admit women students, someone not particularly enamored of co-education reported a real shocker. 33 1/3% of the women at Hopkins had married faculty members. The raw figures gave a clearer picture. There were 3 women enrolled at the time, and one of them had married a faculty man. A couple of years ago, the Boston Chamber of Commerce chose its American Women of Achievement. Of the 16 among them who were also in Who's Who, it was announced that they had 60 academic degrees and 18 children. That sounds like an informative picture of the group, until you discover that among the women were Dean Virginia Gildersleeve and Mrs. Lillian M. Gilbreth. Those two had a full 1/3 of the degrees between them, and Mrs. Gilbreth, of course, supplied 2/3 of the children. A corporation was able to announce that its stock was held by 3,003 persons, who had an average of 660 shares each. This was true. It was also true that, of the 2 million shares of stock in the corporation, 3 men held 3/4, and 3,000 persons held the other 1/4 among them. If you're handed an index, you may ask what's missing there. It may be the base, a base chosen to give a distorted picture. A national labor organization once showed that indexes of profits and production had risen much more rapidly after the Depression than an index of wages had. As an argument for wage increases, this demonstration lost its potency when someone dug out the missing figures. It could be seen then that profits had been almost bound to rise more rapidly in percentage than wages, simply because profits had reached a lower point, giving a smaller base. Sometimes what is missing is the factor that caused a change to occur. This omission leaves the implication that some other more desired factor is responsible. Figures published one year attempted to show that business was on the upgrade by pointing out that April retail sales were greater than in the year before. What was missing was the fact that Easter had come in March in the earlier year and in April in the later year. A report of a great increase in deaths from cancer in the last quarter century is misleading unless you know how much of it is a product of such extraneous factors as these. Cancer is often listed now where causes unknown was formerly used. Autopsies are more frequent, giving surer diagnoses. Reporting and compiling of medical statistics are more complete, and people more frequently reach the most susceptible ages now. And if you are looking at total deaths rather than the death rate, don't neglect the fact that there are more people now than there used to be. Did somebody change the subject? When assaying a statistic, watch out for a switch somewhere between the raw figure and the conclusion. One thing is all too often reported as another. As just indicated, more reported cases of a disease are not always the same thing as more cases of the disease. A straw vote victory for a candidate is not always negotiable at the polls. An expressed preference by a cross-section of a magazine's readers for articles on world affairs is no final proof that they would read the articles if they were published. Encephalitis cases reported in the Central Valley of California in 1952 were triple the figure for the worst previous year. Many alarmed residents shipped their children away. But when the reckoning was in, there had been no great increase in deaths from sleeping sickness. What had happened was that state and federal health people had come in great numbers to tackle a long-time problem. As a result of their efforts, a great many low-grade cases were recorded that in other years would have been overlooked, possibly not even recognized. It is all reminiscent of the way that Lincoln Steffens and Jacob A. Riis, as New York newspapermen, once created a crime wave. Crime cases in the papers reached such proportions, both in numbers and in space and big type given to them, that the public demanded action. Theodore Roosevelt, as president of the Reform Police Board, was seriously embarrassed. He put an end to the crime wave simply by asking Steffens and Rees to lay off. It had all come about simply because the reporters, led by those two, had gotten into competition as to who could dig up the most burglaries and whatnot. The official police record showed no increase at all. The British male over 5 years of age soaks himself in a hot tub on an average of 1.7 times a week in the winter and 2.1 times in the summer, says a newspaper story. British women average 1.5 baths a week in the winter and 2.0 in the summer. The source is a Ministry of Works hot water survey of 6,000 representative British homes. The sample was representative, it says, and seems quite adequate in size to justify the conclusion in the San Francisco Chronicle's amusing headline, British he's bathe more than she's. The figures would be more informative if there were some indication of whether they are means or medians. However, the major weakness is that the subject has been changed. What the ministry really found out is how often these people said they bathed, not how often they did so. When a subject is as intimate as this one is, with the British bath-taking tradition involved, saying and doing may not be the same thing at all. British he's may or may not bathe oftener than she's. All that can safely be concluded is that they say they do. Here are some more varieties of change of subject to watch out for. A back-to-the-farm movement was discerned when a census showed 500,000 more farms in 1935 than 5 years earlier. But the two counts were not talking about the same thing. The definition of farm used by the Bureau of the Census had been changed. It took in at least 300,000 farms that would not have been so listed under the 1930 definition. Strange things crop out when figures are based on what people say, even about things that seem to be objective facts. Census reports have shown more people at 35 years of age, for instance, than at either 34 or 36. The false picture comes from one family member's reporting the ages of the others, and, not being sure of the exact ages, tending to round them off to a familiar multiple of five. One way to get around this: ask birth dates instead. The population of a large area in China was 28 million. 5 years later, it was 105 million. Very little of that increase was real. The great difference could be explained only by taking into account the purposes of the two enumerations and the way people would be inclined to feel about being counted in each instance. The first census was for tax and military purposes. The second, for famine relief. Something of the same sort has happened in the United States. The 1950 census found more people in the 65 to 70 age group than there were in the 55 to 60 group 10 years before. The difference could not be accounted for by immigration. Most of it could be a product of large-scale falsifying of ages by people eager to collect Social Security. Also possible is that some of the earlier ages were understated out of vanity. Another kind of change of subject is represented by Senator William Langer's cry that we could take a prisoner from Alcatraz and board him at the Waldorf Astoria cheaper. The North Dakotan was referring to earlier statements that it cost $8 a day to maintain a prisoner at Alcatraz, the cost of a room at a good San Francisco hotel. The subject has been changed from total maintenance cost, Alcatraz, to hotel room rent alone. The post-hoc variety of pretentious nonsense is another way of changing the subject without seeming to. The change of something with something else is presented as because of. The magazine Electrical World once offered a composite chart in an editorial on what electricity means to America. You could see from it that as electrical horsepower in factories climbed, So did average wages per hour. At the same time, average hours per week dropped. All these things are long-time trends, of course, and there is no evidence at all that any of them has produced any other. And then there are the firsters. Almost anybody can claim to be first in something if he's not too particular about what it is. At the end of 1952, two New York newspapers were each insisting on first rank in grocery advertising. Both were right, too, in a way. The World Telegram went on to explain that it was first in full-run advertising, the kind that appears in all copies, which is the only kind it runs. The Journal American insisted that total lineage was what counted, and that it was first in that. This is the kind of reaching for a superlative that leads the weather reporter on the radio to label a quite normal day the hottest June 2nd since 1949. Change of subject makes it difficult to compare cost when you contemplate borrowing money, either directly or in the form of installment buying. 6% sounds like 6%, but it may not be at all. If you borrow $100 from a bank at 6% interest and pay it back in equal monthly installments for a year, the price you pay for the use of the money is about $3. But another 6% loan, on the basis sometimes called $6 on the 100, will cost you twice as much. That's the way most automobile loans are figured. It's very tricky. The point is that you don't have the $100 for a year. By the end of 6 months, you've paid back half of it. If you are charged at $6 on the 100, or 6% of the amount, you really pay interest at nearly 12%. Even worse was what happened to some careless purchasers of freezer food plans in 1952 and 1953. They were quoted a figure of anywhere from 6 to 12%. It sounded like interest, but it wasn't. It was an on-the-dollar figure, and, worst of all, the time was often 6 months rather than a year. Now, $12 on the 100 for money to be paid back regularly over half a year works out to something like 48% real interest. It's no wonder that so many customers defaulted and so many food plans blew up. Sometimes the semantic approach will be used to change the subject. Here's an item from Business Week magazine. Accountants have decided that surplus is a nasty word. They propose eliminating it from corporate balance sheets. The Committee on Accounting Procedure of the American Institute of Accountants says, use such descriptive terms as retained earnings or appreciation of fixed assets. This one is from a newspaper story reporting Standard Oil's record-breaking revenue and net profit of $1 million a day. Possibly the directors may be thinking sometime of splitting the stock, for there may be an advantage if the profits per share do not look so large. Does it make sense? Does it make sense? We'll often cut a statistic down to size when the whole rigmarole is based on an unproved assumption. You may be familiar with the Rudolf Flesch readability formula. It purports to measure how easy a piece of prose is to read by such simple and objective items as length of words and sentences. Like all devices for reducing the imponderable to a number and substituting arithmetic for judgment, it is an appealing idea. At least, it has appealed to people who employ writers, such as newspaper publishers, even if not to many writers themselves. The assumption in the formula is that such things as word length determine readability. This, to be ornery about it, remains to be proved. A man named Robert A. Dufour put the Flesch formula to trial on some literature that he found handy. It showed The Legend of Sleepy Hollow to be half again as hard to read as Plato's Republic. The Sinclair Lewis novel, Cass Timberlane, was rated more difficult than an essay by Jacques Maritain, The Spiritual Value of Art. a likely story. Many a statistic is false on its face. It gets by only because the magic of numbers brings about a suspension of common sense. Leonard Engel, in a Harper's article, has listed a few of the medical variety. An example is the calculation of a well-known urologist that there are 8 million cases of cancer of the prostate gland in the United States, which would be enough to provide 1.1 carcinomatous prostate glands for every male in the susceptible age group. Another is a prominent neurologist's estimate that 1 American in 12 suffers from migraine. Since migraine is responsible for a third of chronic headache cases, this would mean that a quarter of us must suffer from disabling headaches. Still another is the figure of 250,000, often given for the number of multiple sclerosis cases. Death data indicate that there can be, happily, no more than 30 to 40,000 cases of this paralytic disease in the country. Hearings on amendments to the Social Security Act have been haunted by various forms of a statement that makes sense only when not looked at closely. It's an argument that goes like this. Since life expectancy is only about 63 years, it's a sham and a fraud to set up a Social Security plan with a retirement age of 65, because virtually everybody dies before that. You can rebut that one by looking around at people you know. The basic fallacy, however, is that the figure refers to expectancy at birth, and so about half the babies born can expect to live longer than that. The figure, incidentally, is from the latest official complete life table and is correct for the 1939 to 1941 period. An up-to-date estimate corrects it to 65 plus. Maybe that will produce a new and equally silly argument to the effect that practically everybody now lives to be 65. Post-war planning at a big electrical appliance company was going great guns a few years ago on the basis of a declining birth rate, something that had been taken for granted for a long time. Plans called for emphasis on small-capacity appliances, apartment-sized refrigerators. Then one of the planners had an attack of common sense. He came out of his graphs and charts long enough to notice that he and his coworkers and his friends and his neighbors and his former classmates, with few exceptions, either had 3 or 4 children or planned to. This led to some open-minded investigating and charting, and the company shortly turned its emphasis most profitably to big family models. The impressively precise figure is something else that contradicts common sense. A study reported in New York City newspapers announced that a working woman living with her family needed a weekly paycheck of $40.13 for adequate support. Anyone who has not suspended all logical processes while reading his paper will realize that the cost of keeping body and soul together cannot be calculated to the last cent. But there is a dreadful temptation. $40.13 sounds so much more knowing than about $40. You are entitled to look with the same suspicion on the report some years ago by the American Petroleum Industries Committee that the average yearly tax bill for automobiles is $51.13. Extrapolations are useful, particularly in that form of soothsaying called forecasting trends. But in looking at the figures or the charts made from them, it is necessary to remember one thing constantly. The trend to now may be a fact, but the future trend represents no more than an educated guess. Implicit in it is everything else being equal and present trends continuing. And somehow, everything else refuses to remain equal, else life would be dull indeed. For a sample of the nonsense inherent in uncontrolled extrapolation, consider the trend of television. The number of sets in American homes increased around 10,000% from 1947 to 1952. Project this for the next 5 years, and you'll find that there'll soon be a couple billion of the things. Heaven forbid, or 40 sets per family. If you want to be even sillier, begin with a base year that is earlier in the television scheme of things than 1947, and you can just as well prove that each family will soon have not 40, but 40,000 sets. A government research man, Morris Hansen, called Gallup's 1948 election forecasting the most publicized statistical error in human history. It was a paragon of accuracy, however, compared with some of our most widely used estimates of future population, which have earned a nationwide horse laugh. As late as 1938, a presidential commission loaded with experts doubted that the U.S. population would ever reach 140 million. It was 12 million more than that, just 12 years later. There are textbooks published so recently that they are still in college use that predict a peak population of not more than 150 million and figure it will take until about 1980 to reach it. These fearful underestimates came from assuming that a trend would continue without change. A similar assumption, a century ago, did as badly in the opposite direction because it assumed continuation of the population increase rate of 1790 to 1860. In his second message to Congress, Abraham Lincoln predicted the U.S. population would reach 251,689,914 in 1930. Not long after that, in 1874, Mark Twain summed up the nonsense side of extrapolation in Life on the Mississippi. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That's an average of a trifle over 1 mile and a third per year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the old Oolitic or Silurian period, just over a million years ago next November, the lower Mississippi River was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And, by the same token, any person can see that, 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will be only 1.75 miles long, and Cairo and New Orleans will have joined their streets together and be plodding comfortably along under a single mayor and a mutual board of aldermen. There is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. Note: author Lewis Bromfield is said to have a stock reply to critical correspondence when his mail becomes too heavy for individual attention. Without conceding anything, and without encouraging further correspondence, it still satisfies almost everyone. The key sentence: there may be something in what you say. It reminds me of the minister who achieved great popularity among mothers in his congregation by his flattering comments on babies brought in for christening. But when the mothers compared notes, not one could remember what the man had said, only that it had been something nice. Turned out his invariable remark was, "My, this is a baby, isn't it?" This has been How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. Read for you by Brian Depew. Adapted for audio by Michelle Katz. This unabridged audiobook has been recorded by arrangement with the estate of Daryl Huff and audiobooks.com publishing, which holds the copyright thereto.